The Ensemble podcast is intended for professional financial advisors. This content is created in partnership with our sponsor, Pengana Investment Management Limited, ABN 69063081612, AFSL 219462, and is limited to publicly available information. Before acting on any general advice, you should consider whether appropriate and obtain financial advice from a qualified financial advisor. Ensemble does not hold an AFS license and does not provide any financial advice or services or endorse any general advice. If a PDS or IM exists, you should obtain a copy and review it thoroughly before making a decision.
Hi everyone, my name's Kieran Berry. I'm the Managing Director and CEO of RiverX Investment Management. RiverX is a private wealth firm based in Sydney. We specialise in traditional and alternative assets. And on the back of that, the team at Ensemble have asked me to come in and host their investment-focused podcast. Tune in, join our guests, learn a bit about the market and some of the best in the business. We're here to talk about funds, macroeconomic trends, and what makes your portfolio tick. I hope you enjoy the session. And as always, subscribe, and we hope to hear from you soon. Cheers.
Pengana Capital Group is an Australian funds management firm founded in 2003, managing $3.9 billion as at 31st December 2025. Pengana gives investors access to a range of independently managed strategies across listed equities, private equity, private credit, and listed funds. Its unique multi-boutique model brings specialist investment teams together under one platform, supported by a centralized corporate function. With independent teams based across Australia, the United States, the United Kingdom, and Israel, Pengana delivers actively managed strategies designed to provide differentiated sources of return.
Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of the Investment Podcast with Ensemble. My name's Kieran Berry and today I'm joined by Adam Myers from Pengana. How are you?
Well, Kieran, thank you very much for having me today.
It's a pleasure having you here. Today we're here to talk about private equity investments. Now we're looking to dive in to get some details on what private equity is, what role it plays and how it performs in different conditions and which type of client it suits. Now, running a private wealth business myself, I can tell you that we've got more and more clients looking to get access to private equity investments. And now that we've got democratized access through funds like yours, we're getting asked more about it more and more. But before we dive into it, I guess for the benefit of our listeners, can you perhaps give us a bit of an introduction into who you are, what you do, and a bit about your background?
Perfect. Thank you. So hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to have this opportunity. Look, I've effectively had two careers. My first career was as an equity derivatives trader, trading, structuring, a lot of the type of flow business that banks did. I worked for major banks, mainly in South Africa. You can hear from my accent, I'm not from these parts. And over the last 13 years, I've been at Pengana, where my role is pretty broad. I look after distribution. I look after the relationships with external fund managers. Pengana is a sort of a multi-fund boutique where we've got a suite of funds that are internally managed. They're managed by people who sit in Pengana offices, carry Pengana business cards and only manage for Pengana clients. And then some of our money is managed by external fund managers. If we can't find a best-in-class manager to manage internally, we will look further afield. And some of our money is managed by external managers, and I look after those relationships as well. I'm also involved in growth initiatives, strategy development, that sort of thing.
And before the podcast, we were talking about your tenure in the industry. How long have you been at Pengana now?
I've been there for 13 years, so pretty well established. Pengana is actually one of those places where it's a little bit like the Hotel California. People arrive and don't seem anxious to leave.
Oh, that's a sign of a good business normally. And I guess one of the benefits of that is that you would have seen a few vintages come through in that time and a few different cycles come through in that time. So you should be able to shed some good insights during this session. But how are you seeing the market at the moment? Like, you know, what are you seeing in terms of opportunity in the private equity market today?
Look, what I will say is one of my favorite quotes, and when you say I've seen market cycles, I absolutely have. I was sitting at my desk trading when planes flew into the World Trade Center. Mm-hmm. I was, traded through the GFC, the financial crisis, the Greek financial crisis, Brexit, etc. So I have seen a number of cycles. One of my favorite expressions is markets climb a wall of worry. When things look too good, they probably are. And when there are clouds looming on the horizon, often the risks are factored in. At the moment, the environment for private equity is quite constructive. If we think about the start to the year in the UK, January saw about 25% of the total volume of private equity deals of the whole of the previous year. You know, the environment in Asia is picking up, and the US, based on a couple of mega deals alone. I mean, the environment in the US is constructive as well, but based on a few mega deals alone, it looks like it's going to shape up to be a phenomenal year there as well. So we are quite positive on private equity markets at the moment. They have been through a couple of tough years. Listed equity has run hot, and everybody has forgotten the value that private equity brings over the last couple of years. But we think it's coming to its own now.
Well, you mentioned the mega IPOs, and that's something that's been all over the media with SpaceX and XAI merging. And I think there's something like 7 or 8 mega IPOs coming up this year with, that's what they're calling them anyway, with like Canva, Stripe, Databricks, a few others. So there's quite a bit coming out of the private sector.
Absolutely. These are all growth-funded businesses that have really, and I mean, maybe you'll want to touch on it a little bit later on, but one of the real drivers of demand in the private market space, the reason that we are seeing all of these new structures that are giving sort of smaller investors access to private markets is because these investors are demanding access to a larger and larger subset of the investable universe that is now sort of spending longer out of public markets because there's no need to go to public markets to raise capital. Mm. Private capital is so plentiful.
Yeah, it's definitely changed over the past few years. And I think that one of the purposes of this podcast, and as I understand it, a big part of the audience of the podcast are financial planners who may be accustomed to investing in traditional assets. So it's a really good opportunity to connect with those people and obviously dive into private equity and what it is. So before we get too deep into the tailwinds of the sector at the moment and what's hot and what's not, it might be good just to take a step back and just go over the fundamentals of private equity for the benefit of the listeners. So one of the first questions here is, what is private equity and how would you explain this to someone who has not come across this before?
Private equity, very simply, would refer to ownership stakes in unlisted businesses. It's very easy for somebody to acquire shares in a company that's listed on an exchange. You need a brokerage account and a little bit of capital and you're set to go. It's much more complicated to acquire ownership stakes in unlisted businesses. And so typically, the process is facilitated through private equity funds. So what happens there is an investor would commit an amount of capital to invest in this private equity fund. The management team would then go out and source and acquire either in total or a significant portion of a private company, create a portfolio of these assets, and then work to improve the operations, the profitability, the prospects of these businesses before ultimately selling them at a profit and returning capital to the underlying investors. That's typically what private equity entails.
And how would someone access this? Like, would they have to go through a fund manager like you, or can they make direct approaches to cap table? What's the most common way that an investor would be able to get access to the asset class given its complexity?
Well, it very much depends on the nature of the investor. So historically, private equity was really an asset class that was reserved for sovereign wealth funds, large institutions, endowments, that sort of thing. And that's because the complexity of the asset class suited those investors better. The minimum investment sizes are extremely large. You're talking, you know, 5, 10, sometimes up to $30 million minimum check sizes. The capital is then locked up for long periods of time, 10 to 15 years. So you've got to be comfortable with these long lockups. there isn't opportunities for liquidity along the way, or opportunities for liquidity along the way are extremely limited. And then it's complicated to manage cash flows. You don't get to decide when the fund calls for your money. You've made a commitment of X dollars. They will call for as much as they need to fund a particular investment, and they'll call the next time. And then you don't get to decide when the money comes back either, because when there are realizations, they just say, well, here's a check. And sometimes you can't even then go and spend the money that's come back, because in certain circumstances, they have the right to recall that money. Mm. So it was a very complicated place for small investors. As I've said, there has been increased demand from smaller investors, ultra high net worth investors, down to high net worth investors, sophisticated investors in different markets. There's been increased demand from them to participate in the private markets because they're missing out on the opportunity. You have a question?
No, I was just going to say, so one of the things that some of the listeners might not be familiar with is a capital call.
Yep.
And what that entails. Could you just explain how that works, how a capital call works, and what are you committing to when you sign a capital call?
Okay. So basically, you've committed as an investor to invest your $10 million in Fund X. The managers go out there, they from day one are actually incurring expenses. You will pay a management fee on your full $10 million commitment, even though they haven't necessarily called for very much money. When they've identified their investments, they'll say, okay, well, the first 10% of our capital is required to fund this investment. Please, will you deliver your first $1 million? You've got 2 days to do it. So you've got to make sure that you've got enough cash on hand to deliver the cash to the private equity fund. Otherwise, you default on your capital call. Now, what this means is that you have to hold cash at call to ensure that you can meet these capital calls from the private equity fund. And that means that ultimately, when you are evaluating your private equity return, if you want to look at your return on the total investment, you need to make a calculation that includes the return on the cash that you had sitting on deposit at call and the return on the capital that was invested in the private equity fund, in order to really have a sort of a holistic perspective of how that investment has performed for you.
Mm. Yeah, we see that all the time, and people will use things like sort of short-dated private credit structures or high interest bearing accounts so that they can keep some cash on the side. That's great. And I think it'd be great to go through some examples of private equity in today's world, which people would know of, but maybe are unaware are private equity vehicles. So things like SpaceX might be a good example, where it's a large company, very large company, but not tradable on any exchange yet.
Yeah. So SpaceX is good. What might make sense, because private equity is typically classified with reference to the stage of a business's life when the investment is made, as well as the strategy that's employed when the manager's employing. So maybe what I'll do is I'll briefly describe the sort of the segments, and then give examples with it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's great.
Okay, so very early stage investments, companies won't yet be profitable. They may not even be generating significant cash flow or any cash flow at all. That's generally referred to as venture capital. That's very, very high risk investing. And when venture capital investments are made as part of a fund, you'd typically see that, a small handful of the fund investments would drive the performance of the whole fund. That's just the way the venture capital market works. The next stage of investment, as companies become more mature, they have established markets, they have established product lines. The next stage of investment would be called growth investing. And that is where an investor would come in and help a business to scale, accelerate its growth. And businesses like SpaceX, you just gave as an example, have been funded in sort of this growth capital market. Other examples, it's actually some of the most exciting businesses in the world today that occupy that space. The AI businesses, Anthropic, OpenAI are in that space. we were chatting about Stripe earlier. That's a business that has been funded by growth capital. So these really are the most exciting businesses, I think, that people are talking about at the moment.
Mm. And we were talking before about accessing these investments. Now, the way I understand you can access these investments now is on a co-investment basis. If you're lucky enough to know a family office or a fund manager with a position, or they can buy in through a fund structure, which is the more common way of doing it. So if they're looking at a fund like Pengana, how does that work? Are you open at certain periods of time, or is it sort of an evergreen fund? How does a general investor participate in that investment or get exposure to it?
Yeah. Okay. So what I'll do is I'll touch on the range of options and then hone in on the Pengana option. I don't only want to talk about ours, but basically to create structures that are more suited for smaller investors. What do you need? You need smaller entry tickets. So you've got to be able to write smaller checks to get access. And you need some increased levels of liquidity. Okay. That's typically what investors demand. So there's been a range of products that have developed around it. Typically you see the evergreen type structures that have some liquidity would have often monthly applications and often quarterly redemptions with a long notice period. And then there would be gates. So they would say, okay, well, if we are operating in normal conditions, you can exit after 3 months at 5% of the portfolio. But actually, if the conditions aren't so good, we will either impose a sell spread, so it'll become expensive to exit, or what we will do is we'll gate the vehicle. And you were expecting liquidity, but that liquidity doesn't exist. Okay. And we think that the risk of the mismatched expectations between what investors think that they are getting when they're going into a structure that offers some form of liquidity and the underlying investments that are completely illiquid, and the mismatch of those expectations can be quite dangerous, because when that mismatch comes home to roost, you can have a real sort of event that destroys capital. I mean, think of a run in the bank as an extreme example. And that's why the structure that we have, PE1, is a permanent capital vehicle. So it's managed optimally. The portfolio managers don't have to worry in any way about maintaining cash to fund redemptions, anything like that. They are able to maintain a proper deployment schedule. Because it's permanently invested, and then investors have the opportunity to gain liquidity through the ASX. They can buy and sell. You can buy one unit or you can buy a million units. It's available on the ASX. The compensating factor there are no perfect solutions. There are only trade-offs. The price can vary. But what that means is that you can generally rely on the fact that there is going to be a buyer. You have got the liquidity option. Sometimes there's going to be variation in price, but we think that is a much better option, and it's the option that we've pursued.
So they can buy the shares in a listed investment company, and that gives them exposure to the thematic in that sense, and then also exposure to your growth and success as a fund manager as well. So you get the benefit of when there's more capital coming into the fund, the change in NAV pricing and NTA is reflected on the unit pricing, right?
So the way it works is PE1 is an extremely diversified private equity portfolio. We have close to 600 different names. You diversified across geography, across fund manager, across strategy, across industry, across vintage. Vintage refers to the period when an investment is first made. We've got vintage diversification from 2003 within PE1. Basically, it's a very, very diversified portfolio. The vast majority of that portfolio is allocated to what we call buyouts. So we didn't discuss buyouts when we were talking about the different types of strategies, but buyouts is really the majority of the private equity world. It's when managers will buy stakes in mature businesses with stable cash flows, and then look to create value over the longer term. Okay. most of our portfolio is allocated to buyouts. And what that does is it gives us a very, very solid foundation. And we can then, have some exposure to the SpaceX's and the OpenAI's and the really exciting stuff because we have got that foundation.
Yeah. And I think having the access to those names is great, but definitely your satellite style investments more often than not for your general investor. One thing to be good for the listeners to get their head around as well is how you use private equity within a general portfolio setting. So what are some of the positive features of having a private equity investment within your portfolio? Is it the sort of outsized returns that you can see there? Is it the lack of sort of volatility, lack of drawdowns, hopefully? What are some of the best features about private equity?
Okay, so private equity can be a great investment. I mean, if we look on average over the longer term, private equity has outperformed listed equity comparables. Okay. What's interesting about private equity is the variation in returns between top managers and bottom managers. If you're looking in a listed equity context, and you've got the same benchmark, the same objectives for the fund, the difference in returns aren't going to be huge between top quartile and bottom quartile. It's going to be very tight. In private markets, even the difference between top quartile and median is big. Okay. So the first thing is, yes, private equity on average is a great investment, unless you're investing with the bottom quartile managers, in which case it's not worth the effort. Okay. So that is a point that I'm going to make. And we can talk a little bit about identifying the best managers. It is an art in itself. But private equity really adds a couple of things to a portfolio. On average, it adds outsized returns. It also has historically demonstrated lower vol and lower correlations when compared to other assets. And there are a couple of reasons for this. Some are absolutely observational. You are observing the price of private equity less often than listed equity. So you don't have the daily fluctuations. You don't have the overreactions to news, things like that. When private equity valuations are updated, it is a very, very disciplined process that is followed with external valuers and things like that. So that absolutely does smooth things out. But the majority of the benefit is actually structural, and it's related to a couple of things. It's related, firstly, to active management. When we think about active management in a listed context, we think about how different a portfolio is from the benchmark that it is replicating. The higher your active share, the more different your portfolio is. But when we're thinking about active management in a private context, we are talking about getting involved in improving the operations, the private equity funds have all got teams that are designed, that are especially, they're specialists in different areas of operational growth, expansion, all of that sort of thing. So that's the active management advantage. The other advantages are associated with longer term and fixed capital. So when the market hits the skids, you don't have your investors phoning up and saying, sell, I want to get out, because the capital is fixed. So what that does is it creates a counter cyclicality. When everybody else is selling, private equity funds can pick up the opportunities at that point. And they are then only selling at the most opportune moments. They will wait. They don't have to get out at a particular schedule. So they time their exits to make sure that they get the optimal point of exit. And what that tends to result in is higher risk-adjusted returns for portfolios that include private equity.
And so, talking about the returns and the risk, and you just mentioned some of the positive features there as well, what would you sort of say is the right percentage or weighting if you're looking at, say, a general balance portfolio, a sophisticated investor? What's the normal allocation that you would see if you're looking at a client's portfolio?
Look, I don't know that this is there's an exact number. I think that the rule of thumb is the more capital you've got and the less liquidity and cash flow that you require, the more you can allocate to private equity, because even if you're investing in these structures that do offer liquidity, the liquidity can always get taken away in, you know, when you most need it. So you've always got to view private equity as a long-term investment. If you look at like the Harvard Endowment, for example, I think that they've got about 60 billion US, about 40% of that is in private equity. I think high net worths in and sophisticated investors in Europe and the US probably have mid-teens. The Future Fund at the moment has probably got about low teens, I think. So, you know, it's not zero. It's not 100. It's something in between, and that depends on client circumstances.
Definitely. Yeah, we model sort of our base portfolio off the UBS Global Office Family Office Report. Yeah. So it's the UBS Global Family Office Report, I should say. And within that, they're about 55% traditional assets, 45% alts, and then I think about 20% of that sits within private equity. So that sort of demonstrates, and for those who've not looked at that report, that's a report that comes out every year from UBS. There's a similar report from Goldman Sachs, one from JP Morgan. They basically survey the top wealthiest families in the world to see where they allocated capital last year and where they're putting capital for the year ahead. So we've sort of that. And it seems to be that there's a growing interest now that there's better access to these funds in the market.
So then if you look at the ASFA report, you know, the superannuation report, and take super funds as a proxy for the general Australian investors, we can see that Australians are on average pretty underallocated to private equity.
Yeah, I think that's because they've normally got an affinity with property or fully franked dividends. It's one of those two things that your typical everyday investor loves. But some of those areas haven't performed well over the past few years. So we're seeing more interest in private assets, which is where you guys come in. In terms of diversification within private equity, how do you think about that? Is it something where you say you need diversification of industry sectors or diversification of vintages? How does Pengana think about diversification within private equity?
I think you want to be as diversified as possible. You can always invest with a genius manager who has the best track record. They're probably going to buy 15 to 20 companies, similar industries, similar styles, similar periods of investing. You know, a typical private equity fund would invest over a sort of a 3 or 4 year period. It's not a long period in the scheme of things. So that can work out fabulously, or it can not work out at all. And so you want to be as diversified as possible. What you want to really capture is those benefits, those risk enhancing, risk adjusted returns that I spoke about probably in too much length earlier. And you want to try and capture that broad benefit. We think you want to try and capture that broad benefit. We like that exposure rather than taking sort of rifle shots.
Well, and it's good to be spread. I found in terms of vintages in particular, because different vintages hit different sort of head and tailwinds over that time. And one of those times was just post-COVID. I think pre-COVID was great. And then the post-COVID vintages around that time, we've seen some of those with expected near-term liquidity get pushed out for one reason or another. I'm not sure if you're seeing the same trend.
Yeah.
Which ties into the next question, which is about how do private equity investments perform during different economic conditions. So, you know, in a post-COVID world, we've seen these things run off a little bit. In your experience, how does the global economy impact the performance of private equity?
I think you would be hard-pressed to find too many businesses that aren't impacted by economic conditions, business cycles, etc. If you found them, they would probably either be regulated utilities or extremely expensive. So when conditions are depressed, all businesses will probably be under some level of pressure. What I can say is that private businesses have got advantages, a few advantages that I'll actually mention. The first is that active management. So they're not just relying on the equity re-rating or anything else. They can, in all market conditions, they can improve the performance and profitability of the businesses that they're investing in from the active management, really the guidance of the management teams, etc. So that's the one advantage. The second advantage is that private equity businesses tend to have a long-term thought process. So they can often capitalize on the downturns. It's not like a listed business that's got quarterly reporting targets and investors are evaluating you on a quarterly basis. Here, during economic downturns, you can really capitalize and use those as opportunities to grow your business, acquire cheap assets, etc. Another thing, I mentioned the dispersion of returns between, you know, the top performing and the bottom performing managers. This would all be during the same kind of environment. It would be evaluated over a similar time period. And so what that really shows you is that the ability to identify the right businesses and then the execution of the strategy is really so much more important than the environment in which these businesses are operating.
We saw a few good ones come out of that time as well. So yeah, you're right. It comes down to the manager and how well they can, I guess, identify opportunities and trade through those periods. I guess one key question, given a lot of advisors listen to this podcast, would be, what type of client does having an allocation suit? So is there a particular, in your experience, is there a particular type of investor that has an affinity with private equity over another classification of investor?
Look, I think typically, and coming back to the point that I made that unless you are buying and selling on exchange, you can't really rely on the promises of liquidity. Typically, private equity would be preferred by more affluent investors because they would be more comfortable with a longer lockup, with the potential for illiquidity, things like that. Although what we're seeing now is that the industry super funds are big players in private equity as well, and that's another point of access for often less affluent investors. But typically, it would be, you know, high net worth investors that in our experience have greater demand. We think that PE1, our vehicle, is great because it really does democratize it. As I said, anyone with a brokerage account can go onto the ASX and get this very broad private equity exposure.
Yeah, we found the same, I guess, front-facing with clients. It's your family office clients that have sold a business or had a large liquidity event who want to deploy capital and then not think about it for 5 or 10 years. And it could be an intergenerational play where we've got the sort of elderly family members saying, well, this is going to be for the kids or for the grandkids. We're happy to park this for an extended period of time. So the high net worth families definitely are looking for that. What advice would you give to someone who's not previously had PE investments in their portfolios before, but they're looking to get in? So, you know, maybe think about your advice, but maybe what are some of the biggest mistakes that advisors would make when coming into private equity?
So I'll tell you what, I'll have a go, but you're the advisor. So tell me how I do. Yeah. I would say my first point would be diversification. For all the points that I've made, I think that you want to make sure that your exposure, when you are dipping a toe, you are not dipping a very focused toe. You are being diversified to get that broad PE uplift. So the first thing would be diversification. The second point that I would make is that you should try and ensure that the investment objectives match the investment product. If clients need liquidity, if they have a risk tolerance that doesn't match, make sure that there is an alignment between the product and the investment objectives. And my last point would be educate your clients. The clients really need to understand what they're getting into. They need to understand the trade-offs. There are always trade-offs between the products that you select, and they really need to understand those trade-offs. That would be sort of my thinking. Let me know what you want.
Well, I think the education is the biggest part. So we inherited some clients from an advisor, and we found that when we spoke to the clients, they were under the impression it was like a 2 or a 3 year fund. We're like, guys, no, this is 5 to 10 years plus. You know, you need to understand the liquidity profile of the investment you're in. The second part is to have a very clear expectation and a plan around the capital call structure. So we had another situation where an external provider of access to international investors came to us and said, these are clients of another firm that are no longer dealing with an advisor. They're now non-advised clients. And they said, well, these people want out of the fund because they were missold the opportunity in the first place. For us, that's a good opportunity because we can then speak to the product provider and say, well, look, we can work on a secondary, but the pricing has to reflect the risk. And also we can then potentially work on a discounted entry for our clients. But the other client, the other investors are happy to exit at a discount because they need the liquidity. So it can be opportunistic depending on how entrepreneurial you are as an advisor in terms of your relationship with the funds.
Yeah.
But I would say the biggest pain point that I've seen for investors is the cash flow planning around the capital calls, because people will forget that they're 70% called or 80% called in a fund and they feel like it's an out of the blue call, but they can be ad hoc because you as a fund manager will get out of the blue costs and these costs don't go away as providing ongoing management of a fund. So that would be the biggest thing. And you want to have access to some really high yielding liquid investments that you can put to hand when a capital call comes.
Yeah.
I think that's just my experience. And I'm not sure if you've had the same.
Well, look, your focus is very much on capital call type structures. Our investors, we have particularly tried. The whole Pengana business is orientated around the democratization of investments, so bringing institutional-grade investments to the universe of clients. That we've got family offices that are investing in PE1 because it's convenient. We've got mom and pop investors that are investing in PE1 because it's convenient. And we've got everything in between because there is no risk of capital calls. Your full capital is deployed on day one. And that is because you are buying into a fully invested portfolio that is then available on the ASX. So we've kind of circumvented some of those challenges through our structure.
And I guess one of the other questions I had directly is you mentioned that equity markets have been quite hot over the past few years. How have you gone with your clients? Have you seen outflows or sell side pressure on PE1? Were people reallocating into things like your Hyperions, your WAM active funds? You know, these things are printing 30-40%. Have you seen sort of a shift in that?
So we did. So it's quite interesting. If you look through the COVID period, listed markets sold off 30-40%, whatever they sold off. PE1 was rock solid. But then over the next couple of years, it didn't do anything as private markets were adjusting to the new environment. There were, adjustments with interest rate changes, multiple compression, all of those sorts of things. So PE1 really did nothing for a fairly long period. And absolutely, we did see some people getting tired of it. We had some grumpy investors. We also had some investors in managed account land who were rotating. And PE1 did end up trading at a discount for a fair period of time. What we then did was we announced a permanent on-market buyback. So we said, look, as long as we're trading at a discount, when capital comes back into the portfolio, as investments are realized, bearing in mind this is a six-year-old portfolio, so it's a mature portfolio, capital is coming back now into the portfolio. As investments are realized, if we're trading at a discount, we will buy back units. And that gave investors quite a lot of confidence, and we've seen that discount narrow. PE1 itself is basically trading at NAV at the moment as we speak, a few percent either way. I'm not on top of that. But we do have the buyback in place. It's to your point about these other funds that have rallied, 30-40% over the last financial year. PE1's probably up about that as well, as it has been re-rated, as people have got the confidence, as people have realized, okay, well, the period for listed markets has done, listed markets have done brilliantly over the last while, but we don't necessarily want everything in our portfolio to perform at the same time. It does make sense to have some assets with a slightly lower correlation that are going to perform slightly differently. And that's really the benefit that PE1 brings, or private markets in general.
That's great. Well, we're coming up to the 40-minute mark. Were there any views or any sort of pressing issues that you wanted to discuss further about private equity or anything particular with the fund?
I think it's been a comprehensive conversation. I think we've largely covered it. I think we are in a constructive environment at the moment. I think that there are a lot of exciting things happening in private markets. Everybody was expecting with a return of a Trump presidency, everybody was expecting 2025 to be a phenomenal year. There was a bit of uncertainty. And as we know, uncertainty gums up the works a little bit. That seems to be behind us. And I think 2026 is going to be a very constructive year for the sector in general.
I hope so. I've got a bit of exposure, so hopefully it's a good year. If anyone's listening to this podcast and they want to find you, how do they go about finding you?
Pingana.com is our website. There's a get in touch. We'd love to hear from people. We really enjoy speaking to our investors, getting perspectives. We get great ideas from our investors some of the time as well. So we'd love to hear from our investors. We have got a dedicated PE1 landing page. I think it's PE1.pingana.com is the dedicated PE1 landing page. But go onto our website and it's easy to find.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Adam. It's been a great session. And hopefully we'll chat again soon.
It's been a pleasure chatting to you. Thank you very much.
Cheers. Thank you.